recognizing that we are stuck and locked into the current situation, that it doesn't have to be this way, because I think that's the way a lot of people, and you know, think of it, that this is, you know, the current capitalist system is the only option, and in fact we know that it's not.
Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations, in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexander Kövesh, and you're listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. Today's guest, Robert Costanza, is hardly unknown to anyone who is vaguely familiar with ecological economics. While we could fill entire seasons discussing the topics he has covered in his works, today we are discussing his latest book, Addicted to Growth, Societal Therapy for a Sustainable Wellbeing Future. Humanity is addicted to economic growth, and like true addicts, even if we accept that it is ruining us by fueling climate change, mass extinction, and a wide range of social crises, we don't want to quit. With today's guest, we discuss if and how we can find the appropriate therapy to collectively come off the substance. Bob is undoubtedly one of the leading figures of ecological economics. He's co-founder and past president of the International Society for Ecological Economics and was founding chief editor of the Society's journal Ecological Economics. He holds so many titles, it is impossible to list them all. Among others, he is Professor of Ecological Economics at the University College London, a Senior Fellow at the Stockholm Resilience Centre, and Honorary Professor at the Australian National University. He's a Fellow in numerous academies of science all over the world, including the Royal Society of Arts in the UK. His research fields include, for example, systems ecology, ecosystem services, landscape ecology, integrated socio-ecological modeling, ecological design, energy analysis, environmental policy, social traps and addictions, incentive structures and institutions. Welcome, Bob.
Great. Nice to be here. Hi.
It is a true honor to have you on the show. There are so many topics we could talk about, but we picked your newest book, Addicted to Growth. I think those who listen to our podcast regularly, they are probably by now quite used to us calling economic growth all sorts of names like obsession, myth, and other derogatory terms. But this is the first time we call it an addiction. Why did you think that using this analogy is going to broaden our understanding of what we are facing?
Well, it comes partly from the recognition that we've known about these problems for decades now, problems with using GDP misappropriately as an indicator of societal well-being, and all of the other things that are getting in the way of improving societal well-being. We've also known, I think, about the solutions to those problems also for decades. But the question was, well, why haven't we made, you know, quicker progress on these? And so we were working with a psychologist, Tim Kasser, and this idea that, in fact, we are addicted to the current system. And if you look at the analogy with addicts, I mean, they're addicted because they're positive short-term reinforcements that are very powerful to whatever the activity is, drugs, alcohol, gambling, a whole range of things. And it's very hard to break out of those addictions because of that short-term positive reinforcement. We were looking around for, you know, are there analogies, are there therapies that work to overcome these addictions at the individual scale? And could we, you know, scale them up? Could we apply something similar at the societal scale? And it turns out that there's one therapy called motivational interviewing that Tim alerted us to, that seems to have been very successful, you know, at overcoming individual addictions. And what it does is, instead of confronting addicts with their problem, saying, you've got to stop doing this, it's going to kill you, which gets a denial, you know, defensive kind of reaction almost invariably, and usually doesn't help to change the behavior. And I think we're doing the same thing at the societal scale. We're getting very good at pointing out, you know, what the problems are in more and more detail. And the fact that we are, you know, approaching biophysical limits, and we're changing the climate, and you know, all of the things that we know very well and are knowing know better and better as we go along. But that doesn't necessarily change behavior. It leads to, you know, the kind of defensive reactions and denial that we have been seeing. So what motivational interviewing does instead is to engage addicts in a discussion of their life goals. You start with that and say, you know, what are you trying to achieve with your life? And once you've established that, then you can work back and say, okay, well, is what you're doing now, you know, with the drugs or whatever, is that helping you achieve those goals, or is it getting in the way? So you have to bring them very much into thinking about the future and where they're headed. And so it's really not that spectacular of an insight if you think about it. You know, setting long-term goals is really important. If you want to achieve those goals, you know, as Yogi Berra once said, if you don't know where you're going, you end up somewhere else. So it's really the importance of envisioning, you know, the kind of world that we really want. And so that's, I think, the analogy at the societal scale. How do we build that shared vision of the kind of world that we want? This is something that Dana Meadows stressed in many of her talks. You know, we need to envision that world. Because without that positive pull, you know, then all of the fear that we're instilling in society doesn't necessarily lead anywhere. You've got to balance out, you know, the recognition that, yes, we have a problem, with the positive vision of how we could solve that problem, how we could make the world a better place. I think ecological economics has been about that, you know, from the very beginning. You know, how do we build that world that is fair, that is sustainable, that is efficient in the way that it uses resources, that it provides, you know, everyone, all life on Earth, essentially, with, you know, a sustainable well-being. But what's the missing element then? What is the therapy that's missing? Well, I think it's extending that idea to society in general. You know, how do you get civil society? How do you get the rest of the world to understand that there is a better world possible? So we've been exploring some possible ways to do that. We did some public opinion surveying in Australia, where instead of asking people, you know, what they think of the latest policy decisions, we say, well, here's four alternative futures for the country. Which one do you prefer? You know, and why? And by a vast margin, you know, we get people who really prefer the kind of world that we're talking about. That's more equitable, more sustainable, et cetera. That doesn't depend on, or doesn't even think about GDP growth necessarily, because I think that what people really want in that world is economic security. You know, they don't necessarily want more and more income over time. So I think that's kind of the essence of the analogy. And I think we are making progress on building that shared vision in various contexts. I think the SDG process is very much a step in that direction. You know, I think it's uniquely the first time in human history, really, when all countries in the world have agreed on a very broad set of goals that are not just GDP growth. Even though, you know, number eight is still economic growth is still in there. But I think it's balanced with, you know, many of the other things that we want to achieve as a society in terms of, you know, protecting the climate, protecting, you know, the marine and terrestrial environment, you know, eliminating poverty and hunger. And, you know, all of those things are, I think, part of that vision of the kind of world that we all want. But we need to expand that vision. So I think it's going to take the participation of some other actors in society that we haven't been engaged with in the past. You know, the arts community, the film community, novelists, you know, how do we paint that picture? And there have been a couple of those things coming out. There's a film called, what is it again? 2040, I think was the title of the film by an Australian filmmaker that sort of stepped into that direction. There's Kim Stanley Robinson's recent novel, The Ministry for the Future. So there are a few, but you know, most of the films and other things out there are really about dystopic futures, not utopic futures. And so I think we need to flip that around and start building that vision and engaging a much broader audience in what that world could look like and why it would be a better world for everyone, including the rest of nature, not just humans.
Can we maybe jump back a little bit? Because the stages of dealing with addictions is first understanding the addiction, then acknowledging it, and then having an adequate therapy for it.
Yeah.
And even later on, I mean, you know, all addicts kind of go back and I'm just wondering if you think that we're through the first stages. Like, are we through the understanding of the addiction? I mean, okay, in the ecological economics community, we are. But on a societal level, are we there yet?
Probably not. No, I think that is part of the description and the therapy that we have to work on is recognizing that that we are stuck and locked into this current situation. That it doesn't have to be this way, because I think that's the way a lot of people and you know think of it, that this is, you know, the current capitalist system is the only option. And in fact, we know that it's not. And I think we need to point that out and show that. And I think we have been building that case, you know, for why continuing down the current path is really not sustainable and or desirable. And I think that's kind of acknowledging the addiction that we're in. One way of thinking about it is, you know, if you think of looking at the history of GDP growth over time versus the history of the genuine progress indicator or other kinds of indicators of societal well-being. And since 1980, they've really started to diverge in most countries and globally. So that's kind of an indicator of just how addicted we are, how far away from really pursuing genuine progress or real well-being are we if we continue to just focus on GDP. So I think we can make those kinds of points and statements and build that case. But I think we also have to include in that analysis, you know, because I think it's easy enough to say, yes, we're addicted. But then what's the next step? What do we do? What's the therapy? And if you don't provide that positive next step, then I think it just leads to despair and or denial, you know, one of the two.
When we're using this analogy, I think it's important to see who is the addict and who is the therapist.
Well, it is a societal addiction, so I think it's all of our institutions, you know, all of our interest groups. I think a big part of it these days, you know, are the special interests that really are benefiting substantially from the current system, the fossil fuel sector, for example, or the defense industry, or you know, big pharma. So the big special interests don't want things to change, even though they do recognize themselves. And there's been a lot of evidence recently that, you know, ExxonMobil knew from the beginning, from the 70s, that you know, carbon emissions, burning fossil fuel was going to lead to climate change. They knew that. But they make a lot of money in the short term from selling fossil fuels, and they'll continue to do that until they're, you know, they're the pushers, essentially. They're the drug dealers. You know, we have to acknowledge that those special interests are providing the kinds of short-term feedbacks that really lock in the addiction. And we have to somehow overcome those kinds of forces. And I think there are, you know, there are methods, I think, on both cases. For example, one thing we proposed is to establish an atmospheric trust. So we think of the atmosphere as a community asset that we all own together, and that those who damage that asset need to pay for those damages. And the, you know, there's only 90 entities in the world that are responsible for 2/3 of the carbon emissions, the fossil fuel sector mainly. So why don't we start charging them for damages? And we put that those funds into the trust. Those funds are then used to undo the damages to the extent that we can, for replanting forests, restoring wetlands, et cetera, but also to deal with some of the other SDGs, with poverty and education and et cetera. So let's start, directly addressing the problem, at least in the short term. I don't think that's the only issue, because I think we do need to build this vision of the kind of world that we want to bring on board all of the other kinds of issues that people are worried about justice and sustainability and et cetera.
And in your book, you suggest that therapists are maybe the scientists who deal with this or who provide the spaces for people to work on these visions. Is that right?
Yes, in a sense. I think that's in terms of the diagnosis of the problem, but I think in terms of the therapy, I think it goes well beyond the scientist. So I think that's really where the arts community, the rest of society has to come in and build a critical mass that says, no, we want a different kind. We have a different vision for our societies. Now, how do we build that? How do we get from here to there? And I think that's maybe the missing link in the overall therapy. And I think that kind of process is what works, in a lot of organizations. Businesses need to have a clear vision of the kind of goals that they're wanting to achieve, especially if they're trying to transition, from one mode of operation to a different one. They've got to reestablish what it is they're trying to achieve. If you're trying to design a building, you have to have a clear idea of what it is you're trying to construct. If you just start putting pieces together, you're going to end up with something not so pretty and may not stand up. So this is not an unusual, process. We're just saying we have to do the same thing at the societal scale. And we haven't really been doing that. In fact, to me, I think that's kind of the essence of democracy, is to have this discussion among society to build a shared vision. That's what we need to mainly do with our democratic interactions. And then how to implement that can be the more, given to a technocratic part of society. But establishing the goals, I think, is really what we haven't been engaged with enough.
Again, I might just jump back a little bit and ask what the motivation for that could be. Because even in your book, you're saying, just saying to people, quit smoking because otherwise you're going to die is not good enough. Mm. They won't start building a new vision. They won't start change before they actually find the true motivation of why they could or should do it. So in this case, what do you think could be the motivation for the different actors in society to start therapy?
Mm. Well, I think it is similar to the case for addicts, that you begin to see the underlying problems arising. If you were, and let's go back to smoking. Smokers, first of all, they can feel individual, health problems. If they're heavy smokers, they begin to, cough and have individual health problems. But they can also be given information about the long-term impacts of smoking that they maybe don't feel themselves yet. But if they begin to know that if you keep smoking, you're going to end up with a higher risk of lung cancer, and so that's kind of the motivation at that scale. And there's also the motivation that if they're smoking, other people don't like them smoking. So there's sort of societal pressure that they're having an impact not only on their own health but on the health of people in their surroundings. So all of those things contribute to a recognition that they're doing something that they really don't want to be doing. And I think a large fraction of smokers eventually want to stop smoking, because of these pieces of information. I was certainly in that situation for a while when I was smoking. So, it wasn't, And I'm not sure if you were ever a smoker or are still a smoker. Are you? No. But you were at some point? Yes. Okay. So, you know how hard it is to stop, even though you know because of those that information that you've gotten and the recognition, you know, that it's not what you want to be doing. And I think we're in that same situation at the societal scale. And maybe we're just in that situation. I mean, the impacts of climate change are beginning to be felt. It's not something that people can put off into the distant future. They're beginning to recognize that, you know, their personal, you know, short-term health of their as individuals, as groups, as communities, you know, because of climate change and increasing flooding and droughts and wildfires and et cetera. So that information's starting to make itself apparent that this is not the way we want to keep going, and that's where we are, I think. Yeah.
I am also a true believer in the power of visions, and also in my own research, I use backcasting. It's also building like normative futures. But what I really wonder is how far can we really distinguish between different groups and the visions created by different groups? Like, we're talking about a societal therapy. We're also kind of presuming that everyone would need to buy into this narrative and have one kind of alternative future. But do we really need that? Do we need everyone to share the same vision, or can we all have our own visions, or do we want communities to have their visions or regions, where do you think the narrative can kind of diverge from each other and have very different solutions?
Yeah, I think you can have a vision that's where personal freedom and variability is still a big part of your life. I think what we need to have a shared vision of some basic principles, you know, about sustainable scale, fair distribution, efficient allocation, the basic ideas that we've been pushing in ecological economics that Herman Daly first articulated. You know, so we don't want to surpass planetary boundaries. We want to stay within the safe operating space. And I think that should be a primary shared vision for everyone, because, you know, this is our spaceship. You don't want to be, destroying the spaceship that we all have to live on. So I think that primary part of the vision is something that we do need to share, and that we do need to have everyone buy into. Also, the fairness, the fair distribution issue, I think is a key one that we need to that we need to get broad agreement on, and I think we could, and also, you know, the efficient allocation part of that vision. So I think we can construct a vision of a world that allows plenty of personal freedom and initiative, but that achieves the kind of sustainability that we're talking about.
Yes, and I think, I mean, ecological economists have contributed to fine-tuning this vision, and there are so many suggestions that you also mention in your book, and I think it's wonderful to have that sort of collection in the book to see how many different solutions we should have, we could have. But I found it quite interesting in your book that you seem to equate ecological economics with well-being economics. And that was kind of news to me. Are they the same, or where do they overlap? Where do you think the distinction is, or do you really think there is no distinction?
I don't think there should be a distinction. I think there are a lot of other versions and terms that actually overlap quite a bit with ecological economics. And I think in building a shared vision, it's not helpful to emphasize the differences as much as it's helpful to emphasize the similarities and the overlaps. So yeah, ecological economics, I think, has always been, about the pursuit of a sustainable, desirable, you know, well-being world, one that's focused on well-being, not one that's focused on simply production and consumption. And recognizing that that production and consumption is a means to an end, it can support well-being if it's done well and properly, you know, and if it's done in a way that's fairly distributed, and you know, all of the other characteristics that we often talk about. So, I think donut economics, I think, you know, steady state economics, I think all of those sort of terms overlap quite a bit, and should be considered, you know, part of this larger package of the kind of world that we want, and how to what kinds of policies will help us get there, and how to manage it in the end, but with a key group of, you know, essential features like the planetary boundaries, for example, and, you know, or the sustainable scale, you know, as a key feature, I think that would be part of all of those things. The nice thing I like about well-being as a term, in terms of just communicating these ideas, is that it's something that I think applies nicely at all scales, you know, from individual scale to community to the national to the global scale. And another book that we just published is titled Toward an Integrated Science of Well-Being, that does try to make those scale comparisons. You know, how do we talk about a healthy well-being system at all of those scales? And to do that, you have to look at the whole system. You can't just look at the individual pieces or components. You know, even at the individual scale, you've got to think of the human body as a system and think about its health and well-being. So I think that systems approach, I think, is also common to many of these things. And I think that's been, you know, an essential part of ecological economics also from the beginning. You can't just look at the individual pieces, you have to look at the whole system and how it interacts and changes and evolves over time, and where you're trying to get to with that system. It's not just understanding how it works. I mean, that's a key component, but then it's, where do you want to go? Can you improve that system? What do you have to do?
You often refer in the book, and also in this discussion, you've already mentioned that the UN SDGs can be regarded as kind of consensual global aims that guide us towards the right direction. But there is the Trojan horse of economic growth in the SDGs. And does that not strip the whole framework of its credibility towards a true well-being economy?
I don't think so. I hope not. and I know that in the process of creating those SDGs, they were created, I think, almost on purpose as silos, you know, because they had the political negotiations that went into them. And so they had a hard time with some of them. And in particular, number 8, and, you know, that, why not call it economic prosperity or, you know, something like that, rather than economic growth per se. So there were some, heated political debates that went into what terminology to use there. But I think that is changing. I think there is the growing recognition that, you know, that economic growth, GDP growth, is not what we want. It was never designed, you know, as a measure of well-being. And I know that there are lots of academics, but also lots of policy people in the policy community, in particular that, you know, the EU, I think, is playing a big role in getting beyond GDP. So that whole discussion, I think, is happening. And I think that that's got to be recognized as part of the agenda, that the mindless pursuit of GDP growth at all costs, I think that is part of the addiction, and we need to get back past that and say, yeah, well, GDP is something that may or may not improve societal well-being, and if it does, fine. If it doesn't, that's fine too. That's not what we're after, you know. I don't particularly like the degrowth terminology, just because I think that that sends the wrong signal to some people who would be more interested in, I think, what's behind that label, which I think is all the things we're talking about. And I prefer, you know, agrowth or something like that, to say that that in fact we need to get beyond this addiction to GDP and into something that's more focused on well-being, more broadly defined.
Yes, I think probably degrowth is still going to stay a missile word and something that will always criticize if we're not doing enough, and it's probably not going to be something that politicians can easily co-opt and use.
It gets back to the, you know, we need a positive vision. Yeah. And so that's that terminology is not leading you in the direction of a positive vision. It's saying, you know, we're doing the wrong thing, stop doing it, as opposed to what do we need to do instead? You know, what's the right thing? So I think in terms of behavior change and the kinds of, you know, overcoming this addiction that we're in, I'm not sure that it's the right terminology. And the terminology is important, you know, I think. And so whether we call it well-being economics or, you know, ecological economics, I think appeals to certain academics, you know, and what we were trying to convey with that term is we want an economics that looks at the whole system, you know, that as an ecological system. You know, I'm certainly aware that that doesn't necessarily communicate with everyone that you need to involve in this transition. And so let's go with what works.
You finish your book on a truly positive note, saying that the future we want is already here, and many of the suggestions have already been tested and they exist on smaller scales. Can you name your favorite examples to our listeners? Like, what is it that you think is already with us? We just need to upscale it.
There are a lot of examples. I just think of this book by Andrew Sims. I don't know if you've seen that one, called "Cancel the Apocalypse," where he does go through and document many of those things. He had a nice article in The Guardian several years ago, where he described, you know, Goodland, where all of these things were happening. But you know, it's like the education system in Finland, for example, which has been very successful because they haven't, you know, tried to overemphasize homework, and they've allowed for more creativity and, you know, things that have worked like that. What else? I think some of the transition towns, I think, are also good examples of how to put together a community that is working the way that we're after. I used to live in a co-housing community in Vermont, which was at a small scale, trying to do the same sort of thing. You know, we need communities that build not just infrastructure, but social capital and natural capital, and how to put all of those pieces together at the community scale. And I think that they can work, and they are working, but how to put them together at the larger scale is our challenge. But it just makes it clear that this is not a utopian vision that could never happen. It's not just pie in the sky. It's something that is already happened. You know, the utopian vision for some is business as usual, and that I think is not going to happen. You know, we need to make this transition if we hope to survive.
And finally, I'm asking you the question we ask all our guests: what is your rebellion?
My rebellion, I guess, is against, I think it's about the argument culture. So I've written about this a bit, as from a book by Deborah Tannen several years ago, titled "The Argument Culture," that the way we've set up our culture is, you know, as debates, as right and wrong, as black and white. And, you know, some things are solved that way, can be handled that way. They actually are black and white arguments. But I think most of the things that we're that we need to discuss and that we need to build solutions around are not that way. They're not black and white. And that the argument culture makes it, you know, is counterproductive in terms of getting to those kinds of solutions. And I think that's what ecological economics has tried to be as well, you know, as a way to overcome that argument culture, to have an actual discussion, you know, about how the system works, how the pieces are put together, but across you know, the whole spectrum of views that need to be involved, bring all of the stakeholders into that discussion. How to have that kind of discussion without falling into the trap of the argument culture, I think is a key problem. So this idea, for example, of deliberative democracy, you know, how do you have a democracy or democratic discussion that's not, you know, majority voting? Because majority voting tends to polarize the issues and tends to be, which side are you on? You know, who are you voting? Which side are you voting for? It's an immediate bifurcation, you know, into two alternatives, and there's debates, you know, which one is better. That doesn't really solve the problem. So what is a different solution? And this idea of deliberative democracy, I think, can help in that regard, where you choose representatives more at random rather than by voting in some way, in order to get an actual representation of what the community is. And those kinds of discussions, you know, actually do lead to some broad consensus about what decisions need to be made. And I think there are better ways to have those discussions too. So I bring up something in the book called Sociocracy. And if you notice that one, but you know, that you don't want to go to the extremes of either majority voting or pure consensus. Because both of those have issues, you know. Consensus, pure consensus, will just go on forever. You never make decisions, or it can be stonewalled by a few actors. So this idea of sociocracy gets you toward more of a consent-based decision making paradigm. You know, how do you come to decisions that everyone is, you know, at least okay with, and how do you use that to have a more informed discussion, you know, about, okay, well, what's, you know, if you have a proposal and someone objects to it, instead of them, you know, kind of holding up the decision altogether, you have to get into, well, why do you object? What's wrong with it? What could we do to change the proposal, you know, to overcome your objection? And I think it's a interesting process that has been applied in some cases quite successfully. So I think we do need to get a better approach to decision making and to democracy, in order to really build this shared vision, I think that we're talking about. You know, as I think it was Paul Hawken who said that democracy is a great idea and we ought to try it.
Actually, the newly established International Degrowth Network has also adopted sociocracy as a decision-making procedure. So.
Well, tell them they need to change the name of the International Degrowth Network to the International Wellbeing Economy Network.
I'm pretty sure that many of them are listening. So you've just made the suggestion to them. And I'm sure a lot of people would listen to your words. It's been fantastic to have you on the show, and many, many thanks to you. And of course, thanks to our listeners who have also spent time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode. Bye, Bob. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Thanks, Alexa.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.